Translation: one should worship Lord Vishnu or his devotee for spiritual advancement in knowledge. And for protection of heredity and advancement of a dynasty, one should worship the various demigods. Purport given by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada ki. The path of religion entails making progress on the path of spiritual advancement, ultimately reviving the eternal relation with Lord Vishnu in His impersonal effulgence, His localized Paramatma feature, and ultimately His personal feature by spiritual advancement in knowledge. And one who wants to establish a good dynasty and be happy in the progress of temporary bodily relations should take shelter of the Pitas and the demigods in other pious planets. Such different classes of worshippers of different demigods may ultimately reach the respective planets of those demigods within the universe. But he who reaches the spiritual planets in the Brahma Jyoti achieves the highest perfection. Om Agyanita Mirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshurum Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Sri Chaitanya Mano Bishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapatantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Uta Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Ragunatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Pada Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namustute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radha Vrinda Vaneshwari Rishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanchakalpataru Bhishcha Kripa Sindhu Bhye Bacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnanebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Dharmattu Tamashlokam Tantu Tanvan Pitrindyajet Raksha Kama Punya Janan Ojas Kamo Marud Ganan. One should worship Lord Vishnu or his devotee for spiritual advancement in knowledge and for protection of heredity and advancement of a dynasty. One should worship the various demigods. Hare Krishna. So thank you for engaging me. We are continuing with Canto 2. And in Chapter 3, Sukadev Goswami is speaking to Maharaj Parikshit. And as the title of this chapter suggests, it's all about pure devotional service. The last few verses, has been talking about, doing tapasya, doing austerity, doing bhajan for material advancement, for material opulence. And then obviously talking about comparing it with doing it for connecting back with Krishna. And naturally, Sukadeva Goswami is emphasizing that between material advancement, demigod worship, even pious religion, pious religiosity, none of this actually compares to the value one gets when one actually, takes to Krishna in the path of bhakti, devotional service. The dividends one receives from such a path is a lot more desirable than getting material advancement. Even though externally may seem material advancement might look like it's a very alluring thing, but ultimately it fails to deliver. And it's interesting because here it's mentioned the path of religion, ultimately it's about actually spiritual advancement. That's actually what the main thing is. And obviously Prabhupada goes on to say that it can be divided into impersonal effulgence, attaining Krishna's localized Paramatma feature, and ultimately his personal feature by spiritual advancement in knowledge. So when one is looking at this, sometimes we have to be careful as well, because I think when people come to Krishna consciousness, generally they made a decision that they want to connect with Krishna, especially for people who have been in Krishna consciousness for a while. They have this understanding that, okay, you know, we need to get out of this world. We need to break the cycle of birth and death and go back to Krishna. And these material advancements, they, because, you know, it gets hit home again and again in the scriptures that don't get too caught up with material advancement. We still have to be careful, however, that even when you are aware of Krishna, the tendency for material opulence, good dynasty, protection of heredity, all these things can still creep in even as devotees, even when you are aware of who Krishna is. In the first canto, we have, of course, Vidura, who chastises Dhritarashtra. Of course, one can argue how much of a devotee Dhritarashtra was at that time, but for sure, he had some understanding, awareness of who Krishna is, naturally considering that he was around Krishna and Bhishma Dev and Kunti Devi and, you know, the Pandavas and everything like that. Of course, he had bad association as well, so he wasn't fully aligned with Krishna, shall we say. But still, he had enough awareness. But still, nonetheless, after the war, he stayed in his palace, clinging on to his position, even though he was not even a king anymore. His whole dynasty had been finished, and still he was clinging on there, you know, thinking that I'm going to be happy in this material situation. And it took Vidura, after he came back from pilgrimage, to actually chastise Dhritarashtra and tell him, what are you doing? You are rotting away. Your teeth are falling out. Your hair is going white. You've got wrinkles. You can't hear. You can't see. Well, he couldn't see anyway before that. But the point is that, you know, through all of this, just telling him that you need to get out of here and make your life finally worthwhile. So we have to be careful as devotees that these tendencies don't creep in. These temporary bodily relations that Prabhupada talks about. Later on, we also have, actually, it's interesting, just I'll give just a couple more personalities of Mahabharata that actually struck me. There's a case of Gandhari. Everyone knows Gandhari. So in Mahabharata, she's the wife of Dhritarashtra. And, you know, she, when she was young, when she got married to Dhritarashtra, in honor of Dhritarashtra, and because Dhritarashtra is blind, she put on a cloth to cover her eyes. Sorry, she covered a cloth to cover her eyes. And, because of that, she's known as Gandhari Cha Tapashvin, right? Gandhari Chaiva Tapashvin. She's known for her austerity. Right? And she built up a lot of austerity, because when one takes an austerity, then what happens? They build up a lot of strength, a lot of potency. In one sense, she, and commentators say this. Now, don't get me wrong, Gandhari was a very great personality, right? Prabhupada glorifies Gandhari in a lecture, and even in the Srimad Bhagavatam, when Prabhupada talks about Gandhari, Prabhupada talks about Gandhari in good terms. But he does mention an interesting thing, though. He mentions that Gandhari was envious of Kunti's sons, even though she was very devoted, very principled, had a lot of dharma in her, but she was envious of Kunti's sons, and that kind of really affected her whole life. So when she built up all this austerity at the end of her life, she could have used that potency to actually, you know, let's say, do something amazing for Krishna consciousness. We see a lot of devotees in the movement who have got very empowered, and they do amazing things for Krishna consciousness. That is actually a very good way of actually using your potency, your talents. You know, we have devotees who are achieving name, fame, recognition, and using in Krishna service, which is powerful. And Gandhari could have done that, but instead she got so attracted or so attached to heredity that at the end of her life, she couldn't handle that her children had died. And so she used all that potency to curse Krishna. May your dynasty also get destroyed. Just like my Kaurava dynasty got destroyed, may your dynasty got destroyed. So all that potency, what did she use it for? She used it for something somewhat destructive. Of course, it's Krishna's plan. Gandhari did eventually redeem herself. When Vidura told Dhritarashtra to renounce everything, go to the forest, Gandhari followed Dhritarashtra. So in one sense, at the end of her life, she also attained self-realization. But the point being here that even when we are around devotees, we have to be careful that where are we using our austerities, our potency, where is it going? And of course, these are just devotees. Then of course, you've got people who are just learned, very, very, you know, sort of pious. One last analogy I'll use from the Mahabharata is when the Kurukshetra war is about to start, Yudhishthir Maharaj, he got off his chariot and he went to the other side and doesn't even know who he asked blessings of. So it was actually a choice. He was deciding who to go for. Eventually, he was recommended, you go to Drona first, because Drona is your guru. Dronacharya was the teacher. And he actually said, please give me blessings that I can be victorious in this war. And Drona said, good, you asked me for blessing, because if you didn't, I would have cursed you. That's amazing etiquette there, you know, that even from an opposite side, I'll still bless you. And then Dronacharya said an interesting thing. He goes to me, Yudhishthira, you will be victorious, because you are a servant of Dharma. Unfortunately, I have been a servant of Artha my whole life. He actually admitted it. A servant Artha. So, you know, in the Vedic concept, you got bhakti, which is the ultimate transcendental, but underneath that, you got Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha, right? And these are the four pillars of Vedic culture. Artha means economic development, wealth. Drona was blessed with a lot of good qualities, but in one sense, he squandered it because he was concerned more about his prestige, status, and his economic situation, you know? But then he had that realization at the end that, you know what? I've become a servant of wealth instead of being a servant of Dharma, which he should have been because he's a Brahmana. And it's interesting, Prabhupada mentions in the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, in the purport, when Sanjay is describing to Dhritarashtra all the different warriors assembled on the battlefield, and Prabhupada mentions it was abominable for Drona to fight in that war because he was going against his Dharma for the sake of Artha. So, point being that for us in Krishna consciousness, there are various rules, regulations, yajñas that are set out. We often talk now in Krishna consciousness about establishing varnashram. But the interesting thing is varnashram can be used in two ways. One is the path of pravritti and one is the path of nivritti. Pravritti means, as this purport indicates, verse indicates, putting yourself in a good material situation. Pravritti means connecting, right? It's to establish yourself, making yourself more materially situated, for the protection of your own karma, for the protection of your heredity, and advancement of your dynasty. For devotees, however, our path is nivritti. Nivritti means that we do what is needed in the Vedic system in terms of yajñas, rituals, varnashram, but it's to actually disconnect from this world. We don't do religiosity for heredity and advancement of dynasty. Our main focus is to do it for coming out of this world, to detach. We practice varnashram because it suits our purpose to connect to Krishna, right? Engage our natures in Krishna's service and then get out of this place. That's basically what we're about. This is the real purpose. And that's why if you see the Bhagavatam again and again, it mentions, again, family. This is another interesting thing, you know? Family, heredity, dynasty, these are such strong attachments. In the sixth canto, we have a great king called Maharaj Chitraketu. And then after so much austerity, right, and getting blessings from Narad Muni, he eventually gets a son. And then the son was named Harshashoka. Harshashoka, right? Source of happiness and distress. And then eventually, he begot that son with one queen, but he had like thousands of other queens, and they all got jealous. So they actually poisoned that first, they poisoned that child out of jealousy. And then he died. And then Narad Muni came back to visit Maharaj Chitraketu to, you know, query him, how is your kingdom going? And then he looked at Maharaj and he was looking very depressed. And Maharaj said, my son's gone. And Narad Muni told him, let it go. Work towards self-realization. You don't need to get involved in this family issue again and again. You had a little bit of enjoyment of knowing what it's like to have a son. But now also with every happiness comes distress. And Maharaj Chitraketu wouldn't accept that. He wants to actually bring back the son. He said, Narad Muni, you can do this. You can actually bring back my son for me. And so after a lot of persuasion, Narad Muni said, fine, see for yourself how it turns out. Does anyone know what happens when Harshashoka is brought back to life? Yes, thank you, Mataji. Yes, Maharishi Shokaisi said that I've had so many parents, so many mothers and fathers in many, many lives. Who are you? Let me go. Let me get on with my journey. And that was when actually Chitraketu's realization dawned. The futility of heredity and advancement of dynasty. Heredity, these things, you know, they can also weigh us down. They can actually degrade us, shall we say, if we're not careful. We have, of course, the example of Srila Prabhupada mentions in teachings of Queen Kunti, there is this gentleman who was a rich man. He gave his whole life for the advancement of his family. Then he died. In the next life, he was born as a cobbler. But, you know, sometimes you get people who have visions of their past life. So even as a cobbler, he would get, like, you know, visions and memories of what he was in his previous life. And he was able to pinpoint the house which belonged to him in his previous life. But remember, he's a cobbler in this life. So he went to the house, he saw his previous family, and he said that, that's me. You know, he pointed at the picture on the wall of, you know, the patriarch, and said, that's me. And so all these family members, and then he started reeling off details about the family, which the family didn't know. What did the family do? Because obviously this is a cobbler, and they're very status conscious. They beat him out of the house with shoes. Imagine, it's like you worked so hard to build up this family. You gave so much of your blood, sweat, and tears. And then the next life, you get beaten by that same family out of that door. You know? So it just kind of puts things into perspective as well. So yeah, we have to be careful. It can weigh us down. Sometimes people try to reclaim lost glory from, let's say, they're part of a glorious dynasty. I remember a few years back in India, they had this. There's just this random guy, you know, he's not like anyone's famous or special or powerful. Just a normal person living in South India, Hyderabad. And he basically tried to claim governance of India, rights to rule India based on the fact that he's descended from a Mughal emperor from back in the day. Right? Obviously, he became a joke, a laughing stock. Right? Because who are you? You've got no qualification. You're just a normal guy with just a random, normal, regular job. You have no, like, qualifications to be a leader or a ruler or a politician or a president or whatever. But still, just on that, he was trying to actually claim it. Right? It's there, actually. Like, you know, you can see it came in the news and everything. He was being interviewed by people and he's saying, yep, no, the India should be my right. It's my property, my asset. You know, even though he's got nothing, like, who are you now? You know? So, again, even if we do a lot of work to get this kind of, tapasya, to get a glorious dynasty, even then we can't hold on to it too long. Even if we get glorious children, their children, we don't know where they're going to go. They may maintain their glory, but they may not. In material life, it's very hard to maintain a state of glory. It tends to go down. You see that countless times, all these rich aristocrats in this country, you know, they had their big mansions and, you know, manor, right? Lords of the manor, like we had here, Lord Pigott, right? He used to be the lord of this manor, obviously. Now the real lord's here, of course. You know, who knows where his descendants are, you know? All these things, like, he must have in his mind thought, yes, I'm establishing this big land in Hertfordshire, you know, and I'm going to have a good grand aristocratic family. Where's it gone? Everything in this material world, it finishes. So if you actually want to, you know what, if we do get good karma, even when we practice bhakti, we may get a lot of perks along the way. We may actually get blessed with good, children, wealth, qualities. And of course, as we know, again and again, we have to use this in Krishna service. That's the key thing. I always think about, you know, like I've thought about in this case, you know, Ambarish Prabhu, Prabhupada's disciple. You know, he's the heir to the Ford fortune. He's, I think, the grandson of Alfred Ford, who started the Ford Motor Company. And, you know, I could be corrected here, but I understand that when he decided to go to Krishna consciousness, his family was not very happy. And they actually cut off a big chunk of his fortune. But still, they left him with something. I mean, that something for him is still billions, right? But it's amazing, you know, he's using that to now help Krishna consciousness, He's using it to fund Krishna conscious centers, like, you know, things like the temple of Vedic planetarium. So I thought that's such a wonderful thing, you know. He was born into a multi-billionaire family, and he used his wealth to actually, you know, for Krishna conscious usage. And there are many other, obviously, examples of this as well. In some cases, you may be born into a glorious family, and then you decide, you know what, I'll actually leave this completely and, you know, just focus myself fully on Krishna. That's also actually glorious as well. I'll just read. This is from Canto 11, Chapter 5, and it's, give me one sec. Yeah, this is a very famous verse, actually. Canto 11, Chapter 5, Verse 41. Narad Muni saying this. Dervashi bhutapta ninam pitrinam na kinkaro nayam rini charajan sarvatmana ya saranam sharanyam gato mukundam pahritya kartam. So, O king, one who has given up all material duties and has taken full shelter of the lotus feet of Mukunda, who offers shelter to all, is not indebted to the demigods, great sages, ordinary living beings, relatives, friends, mankind, or even one's forefathers who have passed away, since all such class of living entities are part and parcel of the Supreme Lord. One who has surrendered to the Lord's service has no need to serve such persons separately. Sometimes when you practice Krishna consciousness, you know, we may get criticism. Why are you not taking care of your family? Especially, this relates especially to brahmacharis, sannyasis, what have you, right? Why are you not looking after your community? Why are you not looking after your family? And all these kind of things. Well, actually, it's said here that if you take full shelter of Krishna, you don't need to worry about those things. You don't need to worry about practicing religiosity in that respect. You can just practice just bhakti, and that is sufficient. You don't have to worry about all the different things that generally people need to do in their life. Okay, so and that's why you can see a perfect example of that when Lord Brahma, the most aristocratic living entity of the universe, right? The governor of all governors, right? When he made his first sons, the four Kumaras, his instruction to them was make progeny now. And they disobeyed him. They said, no, we're going to just focus on our spiritual life, on our realization. We are not going to do that. They disobeyed their father. And what kind of father? Imagine, you're like, of all the fathers, Lord Brahma, the father of fathers, right? Disobeyed him. But they did not get reaction for it, because what are they doing it for? They went to Krishna. If you go to Krishna, it supersedes all these kind of things, all these obligations for heredity and dynasty and things like that. Now, obviously, last few verses, and including this one, it's talking about religion, religiosity can lead to dynasty, heredity, demigod, opulence, things like that. Whereas bhakti leads to Krishna, when we should go to bhakti. At the same time, we need to, because we're conditioned, demigod life and material opulence can still be very appealing for us. That's why, you know, like, we're not on that level where we can just chant Krishna's names all day long and get pure nectar. Hopefully one day we can come to that stage, a lot of us, but a lot of us are not there yet. So we need engagement, and we are attracted to opulence. Yesterday, Taruna Prabhu was mentioning in these class that, imagine Krishna has got the best experts, right? Making his clothes, cooking his food, you know, like designing, you know, like just catering for every single one of his things. And this, you know, this attraction for refinement, quality, expertise is something that appeals to us. Like, imagine how many billions of pounds are spent in, you know, they have this thing in France called hot couture. You know, it's like fashion type thing, right? Or like luxury cuisine. And, you know, it's like, it's a sign of like opulence, isn't it? And people aspire for that. Fancy food, fancy clothes, good quality luxury cars, good nice watches, Rolex and, you know, Mercedes or, you know, Rolls Royce or whatever it is. Because we attracted to, we got an eye for that. So therefore, at the same time, we're now trying to practice Krishna consciousness, but at the same time, we've got attraction to opulence. So how do we manage that? So Yesterday, I think Tonaprabhu mentioned that, you know, he's reading this book. And I think Shiva Maharaj also mentioned it's imperative for us to actually read Krishna's pastimes as well from Krishna book, from the Bhagavatam, not just the instructive books like Bhagavad Gita, Nectar Instruction, Nectar of Devotion. Those are instructive philosophy, tattva. But it's actually important for us to read pastimes as well. That's why, you know, like Shiva Maharaj, he developed this whole body of work, right? Navaraja Mahima. So we can get into Krishna's pastimes. And when we appreciate Krishna's opulence, then over time, our attraction for the material opulence will actually go down. When we start get attracted to Krishna's clothes and his features, then over time, our attraction for Armani suits will go down. I'm just giving an example here, right? So it's important as well that we need that rasa. Along with the tattva, we need the rasa. For example, Prabhupada even mentioned in Kali Yuga, Mahabharata is more essential than the four Vedas. Because Mahabharata gives a lot of drama, a lot of rasa, a lot of opulence and things like that. So therefore we are attracted to that in Kali Yuga. So better we get attracted to it through Krishna than outside of Krishna. Okay? That's why Prabhupada also Krishna mentions himself in the Bhagavad Gita, yad yad vibhuti mat satvam srimad urjitam evava tat tat evava gacchatvam mama tejam sa sambhavam. Yeah, which is, all that is beautiful and glorious springs from but a spark of my splendor. So imagine if we see all the glory in this world, the heavenly regions, rich dynasties, powerful. And if you think about dynasty, then the best dynasty, okay, let me get connected to the best dynasty that will never ever diminish in glory. Achyuta Gotra, right? When you go to Vrindavan, everyone says, right, we're part of Achyuta Gotra, right? So let's get connected to the best dynasty. Let's get connected. Fine, we have attraction for heredity, dynasty, wealth, all these things. So let's go for the best. Let's go for the best, which is why once a reporter even asked Srila Prabhupada, Swamiji, your disciples, they have to follow so many regulations, so many principles. Where's their enjoyment in their life? And Prabhupada said, I'm actually teaching them how to really enjoy. What is really enjoyment? So that's again a key thing here. In Vrindavan, there's a famous pastime. There was a king in the olden days called Akbar, a Mughal emperor. He had a singer, a very famous singer in his court called Tanzan. Some of you may have heard of him, Mia Tanzan. And Jai Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda Ki. So Mia Tanzan, he was known to be one of the greatest singers in the world. He's in the history books. You can actually look him up, Tanzan. In fact, a lot of the modern schools of Indian music spring from him. Like, he's the one that established them. One day Akbar said to him that, you know, I proclaim that there is no one who's a better singer than you. And then Tanzan said, no, there is. And they said, who? He goes, my guru. His name is Haridas. This is not Haridas Thakur, but this is another guru called Haridas. He's also a Vaishnav. And so then Akbar said, please, can you summon him to my court so that I can hear him sing here? And then Tanzan said that there is no way he's going to come to this court. He's not interested in your material things. It doesn't matter whether you're a king or not. He's in Vrindavan. He does his bhajan in Radhakund, and that's where he sings. And he's happy there. So then Akbar said, are you sure you can't bring him here? And Tanzan said, no way. He's not going to come here. He's not interested in such things. So then Akbar said, fine. Let me know where he is. I will, in disguise, hide. I'll hide in the forests and I'll hear him sing. So he did that. He went to Vrindavan, Akbar, the emperor of India at that time. He went, he located Haridas's bhajan, kutir, and it's right next to Radhakund. And he basically is waiting for when Haridas would sing his bhajans and would hear, he would hide behind a bush. And he heard him sing. And it was out of this world. It was like no other music, no other voice he's ever heard in his world. You know, and remember, he's the guru of Tanzan, right? So then he eventually came out and he presented himself to this Haridas. And he said to him, My dear sir, you are an amazing singer. I'll give you everything you can want in this world. I'm the emperor of this land. I'll give everything. Please come to my court. Please be a singer for my court. And Haridas basically said, no chance. I'm not going to come to your court. I already have my lord. I already sing for my lord. You know, my lord obviously is Hari. Then Akbar said, look, I'll give you everything. What do you want? I'll give you anything in the world. Then at that point, this Haridas, you know, so you know in Radha Kund, you know you got the steps that lead to the you know, the lake, the bathing ghat, what you call it, right? There was a crack there. There was a crack in the, you know how when you go to these places, they have cracks in the steps and stuff like that. He said, okay, I will accept your offer if you can fill that crack there. So Akbar's like, what? I can give you everything in the world and you want me to fill that crack. Like, you know, it's like concrete step, fill it with a bit of, you know, concrete, polyfiller, whatever it is, and then finish it up. It's like, that's all you want me to do? And he goes, yes, but you have to fill it with what it's meant to be filled with. And at that point, he gave Akbar vision, like high level, like, you know, Divya Chakshu, divine vision to see Radha Kund for what it is. So you know when you go to Vrindavan, you see Vrindavan on one level, right? You know, it's like a, you know, it's a place in India, it's a town. But you know, we know that obviously we don't necessarily always see Vrindavan for actually what it is. And actually Vrindavan on a higher level is actually completely out of this world. Like, imagine if we actually saw Radha Kund for what it is. So he gave him this vision, and then he saw that the crack, that whole steps is filled with these celestial jewels and gems, which you cannot get in this earth. And so basically his challenge was now to fill that crack with a collection of those celestial jewels. And as soon as he saw that, he was completely flabbergasted. He was like, this is it. Where are these things? Where are these things from? I have never seen such substances, some materials in my life. You know, imagine if someone for the first time sees, like, you know, these Kalpavriksha trees, and you know, they have these descriptions of Radha Kund in the scriptures of how they actually are, what they actually look like. And he saw the level of opulence just in that one crack and what kind of jewels are needed. And he basically just paid obeisances to Haridas and said to him, my dear sir, you have humbled me. All the wealth I have in this earthly world, all of that put together would not equal one jewel to fill that crack. And so he left. So this just goes to show the level of opulence that obviously that is there on a higher level. Therefore, why should we allow ourselves to get attracted by this lower material stuff? So Krishna really does have the best opulence of everything. Okay. Even when you do tapasya, and this is another point, and I'll share here. Even if one does religiosity, we know that in the Bhagavad Gita it says that when one practices bhakti, Krishna says, Neha bikrama nasusti pratyavayana vidyate salpamapyasa dharmasya trayate mahato bhayat. There is no loss and diminution in whatever bhakti you practice to connect back with Krishna. Whereas whatever mundane religiosity you do, austerities you do, it may come to you if you're lucky. Because even here, if you look at the purport, Prabhupada says here, be happy. Yeah, such different classes of worshippers of different demigods may, not even that they definitely will, may ultimately reach respective planets of the demigods. May. Interesting here. Even if you reach it, it's short-lived. It can go very easily. Quick pastime here. Now, this is from like Puranic pastimes. It's not from the Bhagavatam because it's a demigod pastime. There was this demon, and he did a lot of tapasya for many, many, like, you know, thousands of years. And eventually, he got to the state of actually coming into Indraloka, and he went into Indra's court, and he's full of effulgence, full of potency. And all the other demigods were looking, and Indra was sitting on the throne. And as soon as he came in, his potency and his effulgence was so strong that Indra's effulgence was actually going down. It's almost like, you know, like you got an alpha male and then you get another alpha male coming, but the other alpha male is way more alpha than the first alpha. So the first alpha's alphaness goes down, right? We see this actually in nature as well, right? So then he comes in and all the demigods are looking at this asura. And then Indra is shrinking away and he's thinking, who is this person? Why do I feel weak in front of him? And why are they all looking at him? And why are they all worshipping him? And then he basically, out of disgust, he walks out of his own kingdom. And he was like, you know, he's like basically lost his potency. Then after a long time, he had a plan. He basically went, he disguised himself as a young Brahmana boy, went back. So what happened was that all the demigods were thinking Indra's gone away. The Asura came forward and he said, don't worry, I will lead everyone here. I will look after you all. And he started ruling Indraloka. Then Indra came disguised as a Brahman boy. And he said to this Asura, my king, my dear lord, how did you manage to conquer the three worlds and gain the position of Indraloka? And then this Asura, he said, first thing, I followed my guru, Shukracharya. So he's the guru of the demons. And I follow him no matter what. Even if he tells me instructions that I don't like, I still follow it. I am free of vanity. I'm free of all that kind of like, you know, self pride and things like that. I follow my guru, whatever he told me to do. And then Indra at that time is thinking, oh my God, you know what? I have to admit, I haven't always followed my guru Brihaspati's instructions. Then he said, with my guru's blessings, I've developed righteous conduct. And through righteous conduct alone, I've managed to master the three worlds. So then Indra, disguised as a Brahmin boy, started serving this Asura. He started serving him really well. And this Asura is very impressed. Then the Asura says to him at the end of it, I'm very pleased with your service. Ask a boon of me. I can give you whatever you want. And Indra said, let your spotless conduct be mine. That's all he said. He didn't ask for cows or gold or, you know, what Brahmanas would ask for in the olden days. Just ask, let your spotless conduct be mine. So then the Asura's like, no problem, so be it. As soon as the Brahmana boy left, which is Indra, the Asura, who is standing there, and then he started to feel a bit uneasy. You know, there's something about that boy, he's not quite right. Who is he? And at that point, a subtle being comes out of his body. And he felt weak. The subtle being comes out and starts flying away. And then this Asura is asking, who are you? Who are you? Well, how come you came up my body? And he goes, I am the personification of spotless conduct. You gave it away, so therefore I'm leaving you. Right? And then another subtle being comes out of him and he gets even more weaker. And he goes, who are you? And he goes, I am righteousness. Wherever spotless conduct goes, then righteous deeds goes as well. So then he leaves. And then another subtle being comes out of him and he gets even more weaker. And he goes, who are you? Every time a subtle being comes out of me, it's like a level of potency just goes down, down and down. He goes, I am truth. Wherever spotless conduct goes, wherever righteousness goes, then I also truth go with them. And then another subtle being goes out and he goes, I am good deeds. Wherever spotless conduct, righteousness, truth go, then good deeds go as well. And then finally, this being comes out of him and he's writhing in agony. He's like so like suffering and just really coming out. And then Asura is saying, who are you? Who are you? This one was really painful for the Asura. He goes, oh, my dear Asura, I really enjoyed being with you. And I really wanted to stay with you. My dear king, I am power. Wherever righteousness goes, wherever truth goes, then I, power, also have to go. I really enjoyed it with you, but I can't stay with you any longer. He vanishes. This Asura's like a shriveled wreck. And then finally, a female subtle being comes out, and she goes as well. And then he goes, who are you? And he goes, I am the goddess of prosperity. Wherever power goes, personification of prosperity. Wherever power goes, I go as well. So like that, so what's the point here? The point is that this Asura worked so hard to get his master of the three worlds. And then just like that, Indra tricked him. And all those personalities then came into Indra. And so he comes back into the kingdom, fully rejuvenated, fully, you know, ready to rule the kingdom again. And that Asura shriveled up, lost his potency, and then left the place. So therefore, we shouldn't even rely on our opulence. We shouldn't rely on the rewards we get from demigod worship, because it can go very, very easily as well. Trickery in this case, other cases, we can squander it away, you know, by doing all sorts of stuff with it, you know. So like this, the whole point is that whatever we have, we connect with Krishna. Samsiddhir Haritoshanam. And I'll finish here. Last point. A classic, a very good example of someone who chose spirituality over mundane religiosity after learning his lesson was Lord Brahma. For those of you may know, in the Krishna book, Brahma he was part of the Brahma Vimohan Leela, where he stole the calves and the cowherd boys from Krishna. And then obviously afterwards he got humbled. He went to Krishna and he apologized. And it said actually, Bhakti Vinod Thakur says that Brahma's anartha that is represented here in this pastime is scholarship, overt reliance on scholarship, and fruitive activity. Because Brahma's the top of the top. So he was getting too proud of that and trying to second guess who Krishna is. Trying to test Krishna. Like, who are we to test Krishna? And then Brahma himself, but he saw the error of his ways and he realized that, you know what? This path of religion is not enough. I need to go path of bhakti. And so he was the one that actually requested Krishna. Krishna, let me incarnate on earth with no power, no prestige, no status, no opulence, no good family dynasty, nothing. Does anyone know who he got reincarnated as? Haridas Thakur, right? Born in a Muhammad family with no power, no opulence, nothing. All he had to lean on was his bhakti, his holy names. And obviously through that, he developed the highest glory. Okay, so I'll finish off with the last quote from the CC. This is from Adi Leela, chapter 5, verse 224. Very famous verse. I'm sure you'll all may have heard this verse. I'll just read the English because of time. My dear friend, if you are indeed attached to your worldly friends, do not look at the smiling face of Lord Govinda as he stands on the bank of the Yamuna at Keshi Ghat. Casting sidelong glances, he places his flute to his lips, which seem like newly blossomed twigs. His transcendental body, bending in three places, appears very bright in the moonlight. In other words, you have a choice. You can go for family, dynasty, wealth, all those things, or you can go for Krishna. You may lose all the other things. It's your risk. It's your choice. But I think Sukadev Goswami is telling Parikshit Maharaj, what is that choice that we should make? And of course, remember, Krishna will only give you a test you can pass. If you do have attachment to family, but you want to go to Krishna, Krishna will help you to detach from it in the right way as well. Thank you very much. I'll finish here. We have it's just exactly 8:30. I don't know if there's any last comments, questions from anyone. Yeah, Tarina Prabhu.
Thanks, Prabhu. John?
Yeah.
You mentioned about Kumaras. That they didn't get any reactions. But at that point, they were not surrendered to Krishna, actually. So they didn't get the reactions. So I'm just wondering, in our life also, we are initially not surrendered really to Krishna. And there is big pressure of obligations towards family, and very often there is demand to fulfill our expectation to them. But still, can we say that we are also not free from reaction if we kind of don't follow that obligation?
It depends on your motivation. If your motivation to connect with Krishna is completely pure, then you shouldn't be getting reaction. Now, obviously, on a practical level, let's say you're in a situation, you've got obligations to your family community, but you really want to go to Krishna, and then you choose Krishna, you also have to consult Guru Sadhu Sastra. In this case, especially Guru and Sadhu, because they may have to tell you, okay, you want to go to Krishna, but you need to fulfill certain things towards your family and your community as you're coming into Krishna consciousness. Not that you just completely abandon them. So if you're really surrendered to Krishna, then you have to be surrendered to the Guru, which means then that you have to then do that. If you then say, no, Guru Maharaj, I'm going to join the ashram, I'm going to leave my wife and kids behind, then are you actually surrendered to Krishna, or are you actually doing it for your own motivation because you don't want to really deal with the family stuff? So it's about your motivation. If you're sincere, then you also listen to what Krishna wants you to do. So in some cases, Krishna may want you to actually fulfill, like, you know how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu told the Brahmana, you stay back, look after your family for now, then come with me later. On the flip side, you have other cases where Krishna may want the children to be completely, leave everything. Like when Brahma created Daksha. He created the Hariyashwas and the Shalyashwas. And Narad Muni, as a representative of Krishna, told them, you can give all this up and come to me. So it depends on the individual situation. It depends on the personal motivation. And obviously the guru all should have a say in whether you come to me or not. Based on that, then your reaction will be deciphered. Yeah. Okay. Anyone else? Otherwise we can finish.
I like the pastime couple, the Haridas and the emperor and yeah. the celestial Akbar. Jewels.
Yeah.
Very nice. Struck a chord with me there, that one. So, but I have a question here. It's not from me. It's from a devotee, but he had some service to do, so he left. Maybe he's a bit shy to ask, so I'll just put the question to you anyway. So, he wanted to know, he's got here, you mentioned leaving the material world, and he says, I like chanting the devotees and prasadam, he said, I like eating prasadam, but I don't have this desire to leave the material world. Maybe because I'm addicted to sense enjoyment, so how can I overcome or desire to leave this world? And he's being honest here.
I mean, look, that's fine. If you have desires, but you still like Krishna and you want to develop a relation with Krishna, that's great. Akama sarvo kamova, moksha kamo daradi. Tivrena bhakti yogena yajita purusham param. Whether you have akama, no desires, or many desires, you come to Krishna. That's the main thing. We have people who come to Krishna, chaturvidha bhajante mam, four types. They're not all looking for pure love just yet. But as you practice the process, as you go deeper into your service and have association, then naturally that detachment from the material things will gradually happen. It's not something you necessarily have to force, repress, is as you practice and follow the instructions of the people around you to develop a relationship with Krishna, then naturally the taste for material things will go. It's not something is forced, like I said. Prabhupada often says, once you get the higher taste, then the lower taste naturally falls away. Main thing is stay in the association of devotees and do your service within the association. I remember actually when I first joined the ashram, Prajana Prabhu, he's gone now, but he once said to me, revelation only comes by service in association. So just carry on doing service in association of the Vaishnavas, then the material taste will start to go. Yeah.
I think some people, maybe in his case as well, in this case, struggle with the thing with patience because they have all these desires. Like, where am I going to get rid of these things? Is it ever going to happen? But they don't have the patience. They might not have the patience to endure to believe that these things will go, because it can be very strong. Obviously, you know the senses when they're working against.
It depends on the level of conditioning and attachment they have. Yeah. So, for example, look, there are, again, you need, these are very personal cases. So, for example, we had Narad Muni. He told Migrari the hunter, don't half kill the animals, kill them fully. Because Migrari knew that hunter was at such a degraded conditioning. To tell him to just start chanting fully, become a vegetarian, follow the four eggs, is going to be too much of a leap for him. So, but he still told him, do something Krishna conscious, but at least do this as well on the, but if you're going to do these habits, then do add Krishna along the way. Giving another example, Prabhupada in Science of Self-Realization, he mentions in a certain case to this gentleman who was very much addicted to meat eating, and he told him, look, if you're going to eat meat, then at least give up eating like cows and eat animals with which will cause less karma for you, at least for now. Like goats or chicken or something like that. Because even amongst animal killing, there's different levels of karma. So he didn't tell that person, give it up fully. So I think for these cases, depending on how much addicted they are to certain material activities, one is a weaning off procedure where you do the whatever material stuff you need to do, but add in Krishna consciousness and then, you know, practicing tandem. And then obviously the authority will keep a close eye on to see how you're progressing. And at one point that he may tell you, okay, now you're ready to give it up completely. Does that make sense? So it's something that is a personal situation. It's something he has to consult and talk to someone as to what is the extent of his sense gratification, whether he can actually let go of it and fully immerse himself, or whether he needs to go through a kind of weaning off, almost like, you know, drugs, rehab, right? Where we go to the rehab center and they reduce your morphine dosage and get you engaged. They work really hard in rehab, right?
So you're saying that he would, in this case, he would need like mentorship and maybe revealing his mind in confidence.
Yeah, revealing his mind in confidence so that it can be deciphered, yeah, the level of his sense gratification and whether he can give it up and focus fully on his bhakti, or whether, you know, his, let's say, a KC lifestyle, whether he's ready to adopt a KC lifestyle fully, whether he needs to go through a gradual process to get to a KC lifestyle. Because it's not that everyone coming to KC is ready to just chant 16 rounds, four eggs. A lot of people, it may be like a gradual process, you know. They might just start off like chanting two rounds, and that's as far as their KC goes. And then obviously do whatever they need to do, and then gradually add on, add on, add on. And as they add on more KC, then the material stuff kind of gets reduced, 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 yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Granthraj Srimad Bhagatam ki.